Hello and welcome to Pumped, the Inside Podcast by Schwalbe. I'm your host Tobias Woggon, and I'm talking here with Schwalbe athletes from the different disciplines, from downhill to cross country, or from triathlon to road running. And today I'm talking to Chris Cosentino. He's not only a cyclist, he's also a celebrity chef. He owned several restaurants spread over the years and is now based in the Bay Area, one of the best places to go cycling. We talked about why food and cycling is go together so well and why cycling is such a good sport for a chef. Chris is organizing several fundraising events to feed children in the US, and we talked about these events and why he still loves to go on his bike. Hey Chris, thanks a lot for taking the time to do the podcast with us. Where are you right now?
I am in my home office here in San Francisco.
It's a pretty beautiful place right now, right?
It's pretty foggy outside, to be honest, but it is a beautiful place to be, yeah.
It's a typical San Francisco summer day.
It is definitely, you know, there's that old saying, the coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And right now it's pretty true.
It's one of these days. So you live in San Francisco and also had one of your restaurants there. And actually, people think no wonder that you start cycling, because the area is so good for cycling, so many mountain bike trails. It's pretty much the birthplace of mountain biking. And so much good gravel and road rides. But actually, you're not from this area, right?
No, I'm actually born in Rhode Island. So I moved here in the summer of 96. I went from Rhode Island to Washington, D.C., Washington, D.C. to San Francisco.
So for us Germans, where is Rhode Island?
Rhode Island is at the complete polar opposite of where San Francisco is. It's the northeast of the United States.
So it's a little bit above New York. Is it New England?
It is New England, yes. So we're in between, you know, Massachusetts and Connecticut. So just like you said, we're up north from New York.
And what made you move from DC to San Francisco?
When I was working in a restaurant there called Kincaid's, you know, and a Red Sage prior to that, all the produce that was coming in the doors said California. This was prior to all the small farm revolution that was happening across the United States. And everything was California, California wines, California produce. So it just made sense. You know, there was two options at that point, was either to go to move to New York, mm-hmm. or moved to San Francisco. And I'd never been to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And at that point, my now wife, girlfriend then, Tatiana, had been, and she said it was beautiful. So we left and we moved to San Francisco.
Okay, so this is great. When you were still in DC, in what kind of restaurant had you worked? So what quality of food?
I worked in a restaurant that was called Red Sage, which was Mark Miller was the chef. And it was I would consider it a Southwest inspired restaurant. So you had Latin influence from all over, you know, whether it was South America or Latin America. And the food was very, very unique. And from there, I moved over to an all seafood restaurant called Kincaid's American Brasserie. And that was based all on seafood only. Mm-hmm. So it was two really, really high quality, beautiful restaurants that, you know, ingrained in me, you know, technique and quality first. And that's, you know, from there it was, you know, out to California and just kind of embrace all this new product. I mean, when I came out here, everything was new.
Yeah. But how was it for you to move? So you're coming from a really good restaurant in DC. Was it like the world was open for you and you could pick a restaurant, or was it really hard to get a new job and get in a restaurant which was so good than you're used to it?
No, when I moved out here in 96, there was a lot of competition for jobs. It's a very different scenario than it is now. It was definitely the restaurant market, not the employer's market. Mm-hmm. So I applied at multiple different jobs. We used to have to stage or be a stagiaire. I don't know if you have that in Germany or the same term, but we would go work for free to see if it was the right fit for the restaurant and if mm-hmm. it was the right fit for the employee. And I staged at multiple different restaurants, and it was not as easy to get a job as it is now.
Okay. So cooking on that high level is incredibly demanding and stressful. How does a sport like cycling fit into it?
You know, well, for one, I mean, when I first moved to California, I commuted to work by bike every day. Mm-hmm. We didn't own a car when we moved here. So I would train by climbing the hills to get home. So in the hills in San Francisco, as everybody knows, are pretty intense mm-hmm. And really steep. So it ended up becoming a form of decompression on the way to work and then on the way home after a busy shift. So, you know, I would finish at midnight and ride my bike home and get home at 1 a.m. And then as time progressed, you know, I started just riding in the headlands, whether it be, you know, I was always single speed mountain biking back then. And it was all just about picking the time. You know, if you get up early in the morning, you can get out and get a good ride and then get into work. But mm-hmm. it's about a balance. And now more than ever, it gives me a sense of solace and allows me to decompress and also deal with, you know, anxiety, because there is a lot of things going on in the world. And when you're on the bike, it kind of just pushes those things away.
Yeah. I had the story that a knee injury got you into cycling again, and then you started to cycle on the single speed, which is not really good for a knee. So why single speed?
So yeah, that's true. I had a massive reconstructive knee surgery the day after I graduated from culinary school. And cycling was my way to get back to normalcy. And then I found the single speed. And when I moved to Washington, D.C., the bike messenger culture was huge. Mm-hmm. And a fixed gear was the way to get around. One, people were less apt to steal your bike because they couldn't ride it. And two, it was just a really natural, fluid way of riding. Was it the best thing for my knee? It ended up, yes, it ended up being the best thing for my knee because it taught me proper pedal stroke. And it also, you know, built muscle strength around the damaged knee. Mm-hmm. And I went from riding a fixed gear to riding a single speed mountain bike.
Okay, so that means you learned it the hard way to
have exactly.
this is cool. And then at one point you started racing. And what kind of racing have you done?
So when I started racing, I was still living in Washington, D.C., and there was a bike race called the 24 Hours of Canaan. And it was a team relay. You would do a four-person team. And at that point, I wasn't on a single-speed bike. I went with a group of friends as a last-minute, like, hey, can you fill this place? Because somebody got hurt. And it was incredible. That was the year that we saw the introduction of solo 24-hour bike racing, where John Stamstead showed up and registered as a four-person team with his own name four different ways: J.R. Stamstead, what? R.J. Stamstead, John Stamstead, and Robert Stamstead. So he paid the four-person team entry fee to race solo. And that was, to me, this catalyst that went off in my brain. Like, if this is possible, this is amazing. And it really set the tone for where I went from there. You know, watching him, I mean, he lapped me I was on a 4-person team. So it really just set this whole new world off for me. And when at that same race is where I met single speed mountain bikers. It was Tim Parr and Mike Ferrantino, and they were there representing Swobo wool clothing. And they were all on single speeds as a 4-person team. And it enamored me, the simplicity of the bike. There was nothing that could go wrong. The only thing that could go wrong on a single speed is you, the human. Mm-hmm. So I really gravitated towards that because I was dyslexic and I still am. So shifting was always my downfall. I would always miss shift. So the idea of being able to ride a 1-speed and not have to think about anything but turning the pedals over really, really inspired me.
That's a pretty cool story. And then you started to do 24-hour races and long distance races by your own, or where you went
yes.
from there?
So that 24-hour race was literally right before we moved to California. And I moved to California and in San Francisco, I connected with the Swobo team, those guys there. And I just started doing single speeding everywhere. And 24 hours of Tahoe was my first solo 24-hour single speed race. And I think I saw aliens. And that was at about 3 a.m. And it really, that's just set the tone from there. I mean, I was competing at Sea Otter at the single speed race there and doing a lot of local events and riding in the headlands and riding Mount Tam. And it just kind of steamrolled from there. And I just put my head down and focused on the ultra endurance stuff. I did Leadville 100. In total, I think I did about 24 or 25 solo events all over. I competed at Mountain Mayhem in England. I competed in Canmore in British Columbia, at the World Championships, everywhere, you know, back in West Virginia. But then, for me, the most important event that I ever did was Montezuma's Revenge in the Front Range in Colorado, mm-hmm. which I was the first single speeder to ever compete in that race, which, to put this into perspective, now everybody has GPS and everybody mm-hmm. has course finders. We had to make laminated course cards to find out how to get around. This was pre-global navigation. This was like, find your way. If you got lost, well, you just rode extra miles. And it was a pretty intense event. I did 7 loops. Of the course, which I crossed the Continental Divide 14 times and equaled, you know, climbing and ascending Everest. I think it was like 1.5 times or whatever in the 24-hour time period. But it was crazy. Back then it was all in a single speed and it was still 26-inch wheels. I wasn't on 29er. Yeah. So that gives you another idea of how long ago that was. But it changed me. Like it really changed who I was.
Yeah, I think each of these races are super good adventures, and you find out a lot about yourself. I think in this 24 hours when you're tired and.
Oh yeah, I mean you see things, you hear things. There's a lot of self-reflection. There's a lot of. A lot of mental strength. I think people don't realize there's so much more mental strength goes into it than people realize. Everybody thinks it's just pure brawn, but you have to really be willing to fight through some dark hours. And those dark hours are really dark.
Yeah. That was a time when you were still on the mountain bike. And how is your bike riding today?
I mix it up. You know, I'm on all three. So I have a road bike, I have a gravel bike, and I have a hardtail mountain bike. I have still not gone double squish. So it's, you know, 2 years ago I did Downeyville Classic, which was amazing, and mm-hmm. raced that on a hardtail. I do Chef Cycle on my road bike every year, and I'm racing gravel events. We do the grasshoppers here in Northern California, and we have Fish Rock, which just is going to be in August 29th. So that's a road bike with some gravel mixed in. So I'm riding everything, and you know, I'd like to say I'm an equal opportunity cyclist. Everything is open for fun.
Yeah. So the bicycle is a perfect tool to get around and take the small roads and see more of the country than what you would when you ride in a car. And when you cook on a certain level, you need to work with products which are high class and which are not produced directly in San Francisco, but in farms, outside of San Francisco. Have you often found producers on your bike trips that you would not have discovered without the bike?
No, I mean, I feel really fortunate to have the connections with all my producers, whether it be Liberty Farm Ducks, which is up in Petaluma, who's my duck producer. We now have an Iberico producer in Northern California in Lake mm-hmm. County, who's about 2 hours from my home. But the things that I find on the bike, which are pretty incredible, are, you know, wild greens. We have so many beautiful things that grow in Northern California, mm-hmm. wild, that can be incorporated into the plate. So we have wild fennel. We have wild fennel pollen. We have young spruce tips. We have miner's lettuce. You have wild watercress, wild lavender, wild bay leaves. So all these things are readily available. It's just, do you carry a little satchel or bag to harvest them and take them home, depending on how long your ride is, because you know it could get pretty tattered on the way back.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I've ridden by a lot of my farms that I buy from. I've ridden by oyster producers when we're doing road rides over in Marin. I mean, so it's, you see it all. And I think that's the best part about being on the bike, is that you can really learn to take in your environment. You can, unlike with a car, you go by it so fast you miss mm-hmm. all the detail. On the bike, yes, you go fast, but not that fast, let's be honest. And you can, you know, there's that old saying, stop and smell the roses. Well, when you're riding, you can literally smell the wild fennel. You can smell the lilacs on the side of the road. You can smell the honeysuckle. And it makes you want to stop and really look into what's around you. And I think that that's really important.
Yeah. So what makes a good bike ride for you?
It kind of depends on the mood I'm in. So I think there needs to be a certain amount of suffering to make it be a really special ride. Because I find that there's solace in suffering, right? There's mm-hmm. definitely something to be said for, you're going to hurt for a bit, but it's going to get you from point A to point B, and you're going to see something pretty spectacular, right?
Yeah.
You can't always get the most beautiful views from an easy way to get there. And I think that for me is what makes it really, really special. Being able to, like, for instance, every year on New Year's, we do the Dawn Patrol. My friend Terry and I, we climb to the top of Tam to watch sunrise on the first day of the new year. And it's freezing. Mm-hmm. It is freezing cold. For Northern California, it's cold, right? And the climb up, you get super hot, as we all know, because you're bundled up. But then on the descent, you freeze. So it's those moments are, I think, really special, whether it be the biggest climb to get the best view, or one of the most amazing single tracks where you're just bobbing and weaving through the trees and that flow state that you get into when it feels just right makes the ride special. And to me, there's no real bad ride unless you have to call for a ride home.
Mm-hmm.
which I have done recently.
Oh, really?
I took a spill, pretty heavy duty spill, and hit my noggin and went over the side of the, off the side of the trail into the poison oak. And I figured it was a good of me to make a call. You know, sometimes it's better to know your strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, the moment you hit your head is, I think, the moment you need to call for a ride and
Definitely.
Be safe.
Yeah.
you know, concussion treatment or, you know, TBI is something you have to be very, very careful of. So I made that judgment call that it was best for me to get a ride home.
So probably the right idea.
Yes. Yes. And I think, everybody should think that way too. You know, there's only one of us. We only get one head. We only get one body. When you do take that spill and you're not quite sure and you're by yourself, it's always best to make the phone call.
Yeah. I mean, if you hit your body, it's a totally different thing than when you hit your head, and especially you should, you should call someone.
Yeah, for sure.
And what do you think, why does food and cycling go together so well?
I think that the thing about food and cycling is food is a way of life, right? And I say that in a very open way. I mean, yes, people look at food as fuel, but food is more than fuel. Food transcends all boundaries, right? You put a meal down on the table and it transcends politics, religion, and family feud, right? People calm down. They can have a conversation. When sharing a meal, it becomes very personal and very, very open conversation. And I think bikes do the same thing. When you ride up to a group of people on a bicycle, they're more apt to speak with you if you're asking a question than if you just walk up off the street. There's less intimidation factor. You'll get waves from kids on the side of the road. It really breaks those boundaries, right? And I think that culinarily, you're seeing more chefs get involved with cycling. Over the years, you've seen more and more chefs get on bikes. A lot of that has to do with the fact that it's low impact. When chefs work, you're talking about a 14-hour day minimum, right? So you're always standing on your feet. Running is not always the best thing for a lot of those folks. So cycling being low impact, really, and it has that adrenaline boost that you get when the rush happens in the kitchen, you know, when you're descending or climbing. It really, they just go hand in hand. And I think the other thing about it is the more you ride, the more good food you can eat.
Yeah, that's true. So
unless you're one of those little skinny guys who have, you know, T-Rex arms and they have to watch how and they weigh all their food, they gram all their food out by how much they can eat every day. But I think that is actually going away more and more.
Yeah.
Because what we're seeing is people realize that to recover properly, you need to eat well and you need to eat balanced, but you also have to crave those foods. And I think that that's a very important part about it that has been missed for so long, because everybody thinks that you have to be super skinny to go really fast. And I disagree with that. I think there's different body structures create different forms of speed, and the recovery for everybody is different across the board.
And again, it's so much in your head. So when you had a really tough day, hard day on your bike, a good meal at night, you recover so much better because of the feeling of the food, and you feel so much better with a good meal.
So, I agree. I think it's positivity. It's creating that positive moment where people are feeling good. You have this excitement. You're sharing your moment on the bike with somebody, but you're eating well. You're eating healthfully, and you have a comfort zone. And when you're in that comfort zone is when you recover best.
Yeah, that's true. So you organized two events. One is a chef cycle and one is a Campo Velo. And you combine in this event food and cycling, but in a very different way. What is the chef cycle?
So chef cycle is a very unique event that happens it didn't happen these past 2 years due to COVID, but it is a gathering of food service professionals, whether you're in the front of the house as a server, a bartender, a restaurant manager, or in the kitchen. You commit to riding 300 miles in 3 days to raise funds to feed children in need. So every year we have this event in Santa Rosa where we do a three-leaf clover. We do 100 miles out and back to the hotel that we stay at. And it's the hospitality community only. So we don't allow food service professionals to ride with us, because it becomes a situation where there's people riding that aren't as comfortable, they don't want outside folks there, and the restaurant family takes care of each other. We help each other get up hills, we talk each other through rough moments. But the goal for each rider is to raise a minimum of $7,500 to participate. Now, every dollar that's raised can feed 10 children a whole grain, a whole fruit, and a whole milk. And those arrive on their desk in the morning when they show up at school. Mm-hmm. It also allows for summer school food programs where the kids can go to the school and pick up food to take home. Mm-hmm. Now, this is something that has happened for 5 years, and it's an incredible event that started with four riders that went from 4 to 15, and then 15 to 350. And it's growing every year, and we're constantly pushing towards raising those funds and making sure that no child goes to school hungry. Because let's be honest, you know what it's like to bonk, right? You've been there. You've been stuck out in the middle of nowhere, completely pie-eyed, and don't know how to, see straight to get home. Imagine waking up every morning and going to school like that and trying to learn.
Yeah.
It's impossible, right?
Definitely, yeah.
So those children that we're helping with food, they're the ones who are going to probably cure cancer or walk on Mars. Not us.
Yeah.
We're never gonna do that. And we're giving them that opportunity to get there to do those things.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I would rather give the next generation a better opportunity. So that's why we, as chefs and food service professionals, turn ourselves inside out in 3 days and to give back. You know, we feed people for a living. That's our careers. Mm-hmm. But to do so, but knowing that there's children that are hungry that go to school every day doesn't sit well with us. Mm-hmm. So that's how this started. That's how Chef Cycle started.
That's a really, really cool event and a really cool program. And how many children have you fed in the last years?
Oh my God. Those numbers, I can't even keep up with them. And that's the scary part. So just think about the fact that if you do $1 feeds 10 kids, right? So you raise $100, you feed 1,000 kids.
Yeah. So it's, right? it's so easy.
It's so easy. And the way I say it to folks is, people like, oh, I don't have any money to donate. I can't cover that. I can't help out. We're not asking for tons of money. But what I say to people is, don't go to Starbucks. Don't have your two lattes a day. Get one latte a day. So that's $5. 5 times 7 is $35. So give us $35 and don't drink your second latte a day. And then you've fed 3,500 kids.
Yeah.
That's not hard.
Yeah, you're completely right. And for people who want more information about the Chef Cycle, where can they find the information?
They can go online to chefcycle.org. And on there, you can find a chef that you want to support. And you can actually support individual chefs. So you can pick a chef and say, I believe that he's going to do this, and I'll give them, under his name or her name, I'll give them money.
So that's so cool. We will do the we'll put the link in the description, and so that's, I really like this this idea, and that so many chefs going out and go cycling for 3 days, and I bet not all of them are super fit, right?
No, and I think that's the best part, is that we have such a varying range of skill set, and everybody commits to finishing the 300 miles. So some people may finish really quick. And when they do, some of those folks turn around, go back out and help some of the others finish.
Yeah.
So there's always the hand of God, which I'm sure you've done in the past, where you put your hand on somebody small and push them up the hill. There's a lot of that happening. There's a lot of camaraderie. There's a lot of support. And I think that's what, to me, has made that event so special.
Super great spirit, yeah. And then you have the second event, which is a Campo Velo. And what is that?
So Campo Velo is a 3-day bike. I like to call it adult summer camp for bicycles. And We are very food focused because they are based in wine country up in Napa. And in this past year, we did one in Healdsburg. It's really about celebrating what Napa has to offer, which is great riding, great food, and great wine. And the 3 days culminate with multiple different rides. People all arrive on Friday. We do a dinner on Friday night for Chef Cycle No Kid Hungry to raise funds. Mm-hmm. And then people register. They can go test out all their gear. And then Saturday, we offer different ride lengths for everybody. So we have a fast ride. We have a medium speed ride. We have long rides, big climbing. And this year, we the two different events, we had mostly road rides at the first one. And then in Calistoga, we have a gravel ride and a road ride. And then on, we give everybody Saturday night off. They can choose to go to support a local restaurant, go do some wine tasting. We had Brett Horton, who is of the Horton Collection. He has the largest cycling collection in the world, show off some of his amazing historical cycling artifacts, like the first time timing watch from the first Tour de France. Mm-hmm. We had Bradley Wiggins' our record jersey. You have Jacques Anquetil's jersey, multiple different beautiful historical things from the cycling world. And then Sunday, we start off early with a big breakfast and another really big fun road ride at different speeds and different levels. And it's really just about having a good time.
Yeah. So I've seen pictures of it on Instagram, and I have to say it's so bad that it's so far away, because I really want to join you for that event. It looks amazing, really.
You should plan on coming next year.
Yeah, I mean, really. it looks so amazing, and I'm, I'm really, the food, the riding, everything looks great, and that sounds like a good plan to join you next year. In the next few weeks, you have a Paris Souplesse ride from Schwalbe coming up with Chris Burkhardt and Paul Rippke. And Paul is always up for good food. So what can they expect from this ride?
So, well, we're doing a ride on the 12th of July in Marin. And we're going to be doing a gravel ride featuring the new G1R tire. Mm-hmm. And I'm super excited to take these guys on this trail that I ride every day. So it'll leave from, amazingly enough, a really beautiful restaurant here at Fort Mason in San Francisco. And the restaurant's called Rathaus. Mm-hmm. And it is a German beer house that specializes. And Paul's very excited about this. That has really, really beautiful, they're importers of certain German beers that no one else has in the U.S. And, you know, we'll start there and ride over Golden Gate Bridge, ride through the headlands. We're going to go by this really beautiful Buddhist farm called Full Belly Farms on part of the ride. Mm-hmm. And climb back up and out. It's about 35 miles with 5,000 feet of climbing. Mm-hmm. So it should be a really fun ride. And there'll be a coffee break in the middle, maybe some ice cream. I know Paul requested ice cream. And then we'll finish back at Rathaus for pretzels and sausage and really, really beautiful, beautiful beers. So that'll be really fun. And I don't know what those guys have got in store yet, but, you know, we have one at Pismo Beach. So I'm pretty excited to check out where Chris rides. And then Paul has one for us down south. And that's going to be an all-road ride. So I'm sure everybody's is really excited to show off where they ride and what they do. And
yeah,
it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and each of these three places are so different. So I think it's a pretty cool thing to see. Yeah, each home trails or home loops.
For sure, and I think that's what's really exciting. You know, when Paul came out for Campo Velho this year, I don't think he realized that we have such a diverse, well, there's a lot of climbing in Northern California. You're either up or down. There's not a lot of flats.
Yeah.
So it really gave for a really fun ride for everybody, both on the road and off. And I think seeing what everybody else has to ride, it really is kind of a telling tale and really allows people to show off where they're from.
Yeah, that's great. Chris, thanks a lot for your time. And I really hope we hear soon again. And definitely next year I will join you for Campo Velo.
I look forward to it. So let me know. We'll get the train rolling, you know, so it'll be definitely have you come out, you'll ride, you do a little wine tasting, it'll be perfect.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.